Well, good day, everybody. As we come together from many parts of the globe, I send you warm greetings from Cork in Ireland and welcome you to this WHO free teleclass series on infection control. Claire Kilpatrick will deliver today's lecture titled Patient Involvement in Infection Control, What Does It Look Like and How Do We Support It? We are all aware that the 2004 launch of the World Alliance for Patient Safety resulted in the first global patient safety challenge, Clean Care is Safer Care, with the particular goal of translating the evidence base into everyday practice. However, WHO drew another significant line in the sand when it designated patient and consumer involvement in healthcare as one of the Alliance's original six action areas. In creating that Patients for Patient Safety program, WHO and the global medical community officially acknowledged the existence of a relevant but largely untapped resource, the users of healthcare. It recognized that capturing the patient experience of care can be a valuable learning tool. It accepted that taking account of the perspective of patients and their families in planning and delivering care is crucial. It's crucial to articulating the reality and identifying the gaps between the patient safety measures possible and the levels of safety being experienced by patients. It's necessary to ensure services are driven by patient need and are authentically patient-centered. It's also a useful validation tool in relation to the implementation of guidelines, processes, and protocols. And above all, it ensures that the patient voice is heard in the global arena of healthcare. Now, 8 years later, I find myself, Margaret Murphy, filling the role of external lead of the Patients for Patient Safety program. And it is for that reason that I find today's topic resonates so well with the core values of Patients for Patient Safety, since we operate as a collective with a common aim of healthcare improvement. We advocate openness and honesty for all interactions between patients, healthcare systems, and individuals. Our goal is collaborative partnership resulting in meaningful engagement and empowerment with a deliverable of safer outcomes, and we view this as life-enhancing for all, patient, family, and clinician. We do realize that you may not always be able to cure us, but we find it unacceptable that on occasion our interactions with the healthcare system can result in iatrogenic harm, particularly healthcare infection. After all, when you think about it, the patient and family is the entity that is present throughout the full continuum of care, and they are also the individuals with the greatest vested interest in the outcome. So that continual presence of the patient, together with recognizing the patient both as a repository of critical information and as a valuable resource in the care plan, are the most compelling arguments in favor of patient and family involvement. So it is in that context that I am sure you will find Claire's presentation not only informative, but also thought-provoking. We hope you will find it to be a stimulus for reflection on current practice and also as a driver for an even greater commitment to fulfill the expectation of your patients and not unreasonable expectation of receiving care that is safe. Claire herself comes with an impressive pedigree. She is a registered nurse by background, has qualifications in infection control and leadership approaches, and has a Master's of Science. She has worked at national level in public health since 2001, undertaking roles in healthcare-associated infection surveillance programs and travel medicine before becoming consultant in infection control. She led on developing and implementing evidence-based national infection control policies and care bundles, and also a high-profile public and NHN Hand Hygiene Campaign. In 2008, the World Health Organization approached Claire to manage the first global patient safety challenge. She has also provided strategic leadership for the WHO Patients for Patient Safety program, and it was in this context that I first met her. She has worked closely with the International Alliance of Patient Organizations and is currently leading on a patient experience program in NHS England. She is a peer reviewer for a number of journals, expert advisor on international and national groups, has honorary contracts at Imperial College London and the University of West Scotland, and recently enjoyed leading on the pros of patient engagement in a debate with Dr. Yves Longpan at the ECCMID 2012. Claire is also keenly interested in how social media can influence patient safety and patient engagement. Before I hand over to Claire herself, I will just remind you that we are unable to take questions following her presentation, but time permitting, Claire and I may have a short discussion. Should you have questions or require clarification, we would be delighted to address these if you would kindly use the email address provided on the Weber training site. And now to business. It is over to you, Claire.
Thank you very much, Margaret, and welcome everyone, and good morning, good afternoon, etc. to you all. Thank you, Paul, as well, for hosting yet another free WHO teleclass. Margaret, it's my great pleasure to talk on this subject, as I'm sure you know, having worked together with you, and indeed a great pleasure to have this teleclass hosted by you. Today, as Margaret has already clearly described, I'm aiming to talk to you about patient involvement, particularly around infection control, what it looks like, and I have a lot of information to present to you, and how we can support it. And as Margaret has said, this is to be thought-provoking and stimulating. It is still a question. We've got a lot of information to rapidly cover, and I hope that that will actually empower all of you who have joined today to go back and ask those questions and challenge people's thinkings, beliefs, attitudes and actions. Next slide. I recently decided to ask a number of colleagues from around the globe, having the privilege to be able to do that in my line of work, what they really thought about patient involvement in infection control. And a leading infectious disease physician surprised me when he came up with this quote. So we debated it for a while, and we'd been discussing for quite some time around the topic, when I said, no, tell me really, what do you really think about it in practice? And he said, no one really does it. And I said, or no one really thinks that they do it. And he said, everyone hates it. And I said, or they think that they hate it because they just don't quite understand. He then said, but it works, and we know it works. And that was where we agreed. This is really important because we are already at an early stage in this presentation, recognising that a lot of this and how we're going to achieve patient involvement, etc., is truly around attitudes and behaviours. Next slide. To overview the session, I'm not going to apologise for the particular bias that is presented here, which is that I will talk about the reasons why we should consider patient participation and empowerment in infection control. As Margaret has mentioned, I was fortunate enough to debate alongside Dr. Yves Longpan from Canada at the ECCMID conference this year the pros and cons of patient engagement. And I was, as I say, lucky to do the patient engagement pros in that instance. So today what I'm actually going to do is kind of debate amongst myself, really, the two lectures that were given by myself and Eve at that time. But you can see here, as I say, that what I'm actually going to tell you is a lot of information around how we believe it can work and that there is evidence to tell us that, and we need to continue to overcome those challenges. Having worked in this field for quite some years, as you heard, I believe it's now a time for infection prevention and control professionals and those with any interest in this topic whatsoever to be seen as true leaders at a time when healthcare in many countries around the globe is truly changing for a number of reasons. We have to consider new approaches to how we're managing things on a day-to-day basis, to the challenges that are with us now from microorganisms or that are going to be upon us at any given moment, And we have to think, we've been doing it in a certain way for some time, and that's fine, but how are we going to think innovatively about how we're going to face the challenges of the future? And I truly believe, to demonstrate that we are leaders, we have to be thinking about an infection control revolution hand in hand with a patient revolution that will actually achieve the best outcome together. Next slide. Useful to mention that the WHO guidelines on hand hygiene in healthcare in 2009 had already done a huge amount of work looking at patient empowerment and working together with patients to address that aspect of infection control. WHO have addressed patient involvement and empowerment in a number of other topics, but it's safe to say, as Margaret has highlighted, that the patient safety programme has had it really as a focus throughout its work, including as part of Patients for Patient Safety and as part of the Clean Care is Safer Care programme, which indeed includes the output of the WHO guidelines on hand hygiene in healthcare. And it recognises that it's a process through which people gain greater control over the decisions and actions affecting their health. And when that comes to hand hygiene, that shouldn't really be difficult, but yet it is on an ongoing basis. Next slide. Again, very privileged to have worked with Margaret and to be able to debate on email with her, what does it really mean? And I think if all of those of you who are listening don't take anything else away from this lecture, there are one or two key messages, and this is one of them. We need to dispel some of the myths around what it really means and make it easier for it to happen in the right way at the right time. Terms are often used interchangeably. But here we have here Margaret's wisdom on this topic around the fact that participation is actually in one's care pathway, which we see for a number of different health concerns, potentially not always related to infection control, but certainly that's vital. We see patient engagement often initiated by the provider. That's often when preparing leaflets, running campaigns, and asking for input. And that's okay, but we have to be thinking about how engagement can be more two-way. We see representation at specific fora, and that has been growing over the years, and certainly a lot of my work has been around having groups set up, making sure that patient representation is on there, and indeed that has worked in some instances, but I strongly believe that it cannot be a tick box exercise where a patient representative on a group who's invited on means that we have truly engaged our patients, and we have to be very careful about that approach. Involvement is a lot of the leadership that Margaret is giving around the nothing about us without us, meaning that involvement should span policy, regulation, research, education, and the practices that go on every day. And that's a lot of the achievements that are being made by Patients for Patient Safety representatives around the globe, national patient groups, including in topics like MRSA, etc. And indeed, think about it. The next time that you're preparing a policy or setting up a new piece of research, how do you make sure that this works hand in hand with patient involvement, because it will achieve the best outcome? And of course, to make sure that any of these or all of these four hooks are into reality, it has to be strategically managed and it has to be thought through, because as I say, although I believe this can work, there are many challenges to it. Next slide. Just bringing us back to some of the key literature on this topic and around how it can work, it can, in different walks of life within healthcare. Charles Vincent has published broadly on this field, as I'm sure many of you will know, and actually gives us a lot of information around how, for example, in this article, patients and families can be safety experts and can make that difference to outcome. That impact has been published, and although not associated with infection control in all instances, we have to learn the lessons from such literature and look at applying them to the challenges that we have in infection control. Healthcare is often compared with aviation, and we have learned a lot from their systems and processes, and certainly the checklist developed by WHO and others have certainly concurred with this. However, Charles Vincent clearly points out that healthcare is unlike aviation in that the patient is a privileged witness of events, both in the sense that they are at the centre of the process, and unlike clinical staff who come and go, they observe the whole process of care. This is truly powerful if we capitalise on that position that the patient is in. Now, I'm not being unrealistic in saying that every patient will be able to do that and be able to provide the powerful feedback that we need to improve and to make sure we have safer practices. But indeed, some of them can. Not those in intensive care units, but those in other settings who would be able to work with us. And I'm sure many of you are involved in patient feedback exercises, and it's certainly something I'm heavily involved in at this moment in time, and I'll come on and explain a bit more about that. Next slide. Just to present some of the data to you and bring it back to infection control, many of you again will know this study, but it was about the Clean Your Hands campaign, which was run in England, which is about getting the patients to ask about hospital hand hygiene practices. The methods that were used were surveys of public, inpatient and healthcare workers. And I've summarised just some of these because, again, I believe this is powerful information despite the limitations of the study, which we have to use. If in any way you are feeling strongly about patient empowerment and engagement, these data are strong and are important. 57% of the public were unlikely to ask doctors questions. But that means that 43% are pretty much likely to do it. We're ignoring those people who feel strongly about the fact that they would like to be involved. So yes, there's a barrier, there is some uncertainty, which we will discuss today, around those unlikely to ask and why, but some of them are likely to ask, and we have to understand more about that. 20% of inpatients do not want healthcare workers to think that they are questioning them. Does this mean that 80% wouldn't mind? Actually, they thought that healthcare workers were questioning them. 71% of healthcare workers said that healthcare-associated infection could be reduced if patient asked. That's really strong information. And, of course, that potentially means that 29% aren't sure, but certainly we could be influencing them to come on and talk about how it can make their job easier if healthcare workers include patients in this activity. This is one of the first studies to assess simultaneously the opinion of several stakeholders. And again, another question and another take-home message will be, why is this the case and why are we not doing more in the field of infection control to understand simultaneously how we can influence healthcare workers and patients together to make sure they are working together better? Next slide. So more information from both NPSA and WHO. 71% of patients, and 374 patients in 9 hospitals said that they should be involved in ensuring hand hygiene. Again, it means that people are keen to be involved, and we need to capitalise on that in whichever shape or form we feel would work best in our settings and we are most comfortable with. 53% of those said they would ask their healthcare worker. But given a real-life situation, this actually fell to 26%, which I'm sure would surprise none of us. Often we feel stronger in our minds and how we're going to approach something. Given a situation, that can change. But focusing on Dr. Allegrandi's publication in 2009, you can see here that actually 78% they should be involved in helping improve, and it increased to 90% given specific clinical situations. So we have to use that. People will respond to real-life situations, and we have to help them understand what are those key situations where it would be best that they got involved. And that pertains to, of course, the right times for hand hygiene, the 5 moments for hand hygiene. Dr. Allegrandi's work, of course, showed, among others, that there are many factors that influence whether people will feel comfortable to ask or not. Next slide. And taking that information, again, in recent times, over the last year, I started to investigate, and this is not full and proper evaluation, but I started to investigate more about where certain settings, that those population, the demographic of those populations, might be best suited to be involved and to be engaged in partnering with healthcare workers to ensure a better outcome. And an interesting example that I found was around involving blood donors and ensuring hand hygiene. And using a multimodal strategy, of course, to make this happen, you can clearly see some of the steps that I unpicked when talking to colleagues about this, but why it worked in that setting and how we could project that onto other settings, or maybe understand why in some settings it won't work as well. And asking these colleagues, it was clear that there was a step within a standard operating procedure that not only outlined when hand hygiene should be performed by those healthcare workers, but actually outlined that it was going to be at a moment when they would interact with the blood donor, who would either ask or should be told why hand hygiene was occurring. This service is also tightly regulated and has a clear mandate, which may again be a strong influence. And that is tied in with the fact that it's very tightly the same procedure every time. The ergonomics of the whole situation tends to be managed better, the same every time. And therefore, you can ensure that items are in the right place and are not often missing, for example, alcohol hand rub or posters. You can be sure that the environment is best suited to the healthcare worker and the patient knowing what the action should be every single time the procedure is applied, and indeed what the outcome should be and what it will be if those practices are not adhered to. So some stimulation and thinking for you around settings where it maybe can work better and how can we use that information for other settings. Next slide. I think it's important to emphasise that it's not just about having patients ask about hand hygiene or other aspects of infection control, like should their line come out now, has their IV line been in too long. There are lots of different ways in which it's been applied in different settings, which I'm not presenting full evaluation of today, but you will have many examples of too, and I certainly have from my practices. And these include showing cards, and these include being part of surveys. Actually, patients and representatives or patients just after discharge actually undertaking surveys. So we need to think about the different approaches that will work. Next slide. And this relates to when patient participation might best be suited. And we have examples, again, from other parts of healthcare, and diabetes is a good example, where patient participation does feature in diagnosis, decision-making, and treatment and monitoring. And that may well happen for infection situations, for example, post-operative surgical site infections. But what we want to focus on, and what I think we have a great opportunity to address in this infection control and patient revolution, is error prevention, which is where the whole aspect of engaging healthcare workers and patients around hand hygiene, for example, originated. Next slide. And building on that, as I say, I think it creates a great opportunity to show that infection control can excel in an area of patient participation by thinking about how it can prevent errors, prevent harm, and improve patient safety. And again, in some NPSA unpublished work, healthcare workers stated that they felt it was a useful prompt. It actually helped relatives understand cross-infection. But of course, it depended on how the question was asked. And that's where we have to look at how, again, the interaction between patients and healthcare workers can be better understood. Next slide. This conceptual model of factors that influence patient participation in preventing errors is a very powerful model that I personally don't believe is being applied yet enough in practice, while I think it really gives us a true indication of how we can achieve power and responsibility sharing between patients and healthcare workers at relevant and appropriate times. When you look at the healthcare worker-related factors, you can see that none of these will be a surprise to you. We need to address together the acceptance of this new healthcare worker role, that they will be challenged, that they will be engaged to discuss these types of things with patients. Training will be critical in the healthcare worker and patient relationship. Support from an institution and how we change those behaviours and support those roles will be critical. And we have to address those common barriers of lack of time, beliefs, all the different variables that we know affect this dynamic and the types of problems that occur. I strongly believe that at the same time, we have to address the patient-related factors. And I certainly don't have many examples of where healthcare-related factors and patient-related factors have come together to achieve a greater outcome for this patient participation and healthcare worker satisfaction and having an easier day at work every day. I don't believe that together they have been addressed. For example, the project I'm currently involved in is training healthcare workers who work pretty much with computers every day, are very computer literate, to actually get reports from patient surveys, patient experience feedback out of that system on a daily basis to make sure they use that feedback and have action plans to improve, or indeed have rewards for staff where they really are receiving excellent feedback from patients. We're investing time in those healthcare workers using that simple system, but at the same time, we're expecting our patients to input their information into that system without any investment in how to train them on it and how to support them through that. That's a lesson, I believe, that fits in with this model, but how we will have to actually look at the patient and the healthcare worker related factors that exist and address them both together, as many of them as we can. Some of them will not be resolved, but patients who are able and who are willing to actually look at supporting their, for example, health literacy and knowledge. And for those of you who have not read this paper, I think this probably is my second take-home message today around with dispelling the myths of what it really means. Actually looking at this paper and understanding clearly what that means and how you could apply it to your projects. And in fact, it's been supported by further work, which has been published, which says that patient and healthcare worker engagement at the same time will lead to a better outcome. Next slide. Making our jobs easier will not happen overnight, and that means that we have to stimulate change in different ways in order to achieve a long-term change in healthcare practices, changing roles, changing dynamics, and changing behaviours overall within the system. By looking at the patient involvement and participation, we can address interactions among the humans that exist within healthcare, staff and patients, and the other elements of the system. And I do believe, again, that this is critical, given that we know there are a number of human factors projects currently on the go around different healthcare settings, and how well are they engaging the patients to make sure that that dynamic of interaction with all of those people and all of that equipment within our systems and environments actually do work at their best together. We need to consider the patients in that approach, and we need to use their feedback to inform our human factors approaches to improving our systems, processes and outcomes. What I find fascinating about the barriers to and those who have felt uncomfortable about being asked about their hand hygiene is that a lot of initiatives are now actually showing that the exact opposite. Healthcare workers actually want patients to stop, wait and then ask in order that they're not interrupted while delivering important care. And because they want to respect patients' meal times, patients' bathing times, patient communications. So they have ways, for example here, a red peg, to show that they should not be disturbed in order to protect their time. Now, if healthcare workers can ask patients to respect, stop, wait and ask, I do believe that patients can ask healthcare workers the same. Stop, wait, I want to ask. Can you please respect that this is my time to talk to you? And I think that has to go both ways. And again, that's about working together on these initiatives. Next slide. Bringing it back to a global level, and just to remind you how crucial this work is and how many people have actually picked up on the importance of patient empowerment in order to make it work, make our jobs easier, to have a better outcome for staff and for patients. In the guidelines that was presented, following years of working with a number of countries and investigating, that there were quite a number of countries who were already looking at patient empowerment strategies. And this wasn't particularly related to hand hygiene. But I do think it's important to realise that often these strategies can be applied to a number of different factors that occur within infection control and other patient participation pathways. But these examples here are hand hygiene. So you can see a number of countries, including the countries in which and Margaret and I have worked, and many of you, I'm sure, actually were developing or implementing patient empowerment approaches for hand hygiene. Over the years, we've seen a few of those publications, like those from England that I presented to you, but we aren't really clear on where all of them have gone and what the results have been. And we do need to encourage people to be talking up more, not just about the barriers, but where they've even had small cases of success and how they've achieved that, because I'm sure there are many examples, and in fact we're just not publishing so much on those. What WHO has done as a follow-up though, and many of you may be involved in this, was undertake a global survey using a hand hygiene self-assessment framework, which was issued in 2010 by WHO, and throughout that, 2011, get my years mixed up, and this year, what WHO did over the last year, that the framework was issued, we asked people to complete it, and we pulled in their responses to this survey, and on 5th of May, the Save Lives, Clean Your Hands Global Annual Day of 2012, the survey results, high-level survey results, were issued, and it showed that 2,120 healthcare settings from 70 countries had completed this assessment and given WHO their results. And what this assessment does is allows you to track your progress with hand hygiene improvement. It's based on the multimodal strategy that was developed by WHO and is published in their guidelines, and actually helps you to look at elements of that strategy and how well you are doing against each, and help you focus on where you need to improve. Part of that assessment is around looking about patients being informed about the importance of hand hygiene and programs of patient engagement. And you can see the results here, probably not surprisingly, that informing patients about hand hygiene has become more and more common, but actually having formalised programs of patient engagement is still relatively low. And to be fair, in the guidelines and in the framework, it talks about implementing this aspect once you have established many other aspects of hand hygiene improvement. Next slide. You cannot discuss patient engagement, empowerment, participation and involvement without thinking about how it would feel if it was you. Not everyone will respond to emotive marketing, emotive information. I certainly do. I certainly don't want to be the person that has been harmed and it could have been avoided. I don't think any of us would want to be. And certainly, you may be able to use some of these data, some of this information, to actually convince others how important this is. But it won't work for everyone. And I give you a personal example of this. I was recently with a family member attending a hospital appointment for admission, and the healthcare worker undertook the MRSA pre-admission screening on my relative. They did not explain what they were doing. My relative did not ask what they were doing. I was distressed. I wanted that explanation to be given. I wanted it to be clear. My relative didn't. They were happy. They trusted that healthcare worker. How we feel about how we are cared for will be different between every different person. But we do know, as Margaret has clearly outlined to start with, and from all of the literature and all of our knowledge, that patients absolutely have the right to be involved, to be informed, and indeed there can be a greater impact if we work better together. And many patients are advocating for this, as you can see here from work that was done in England and from indeed an excellent book from Dr. Marianne McGuckin in the United States looking at a patient survival guide, as well as articles that have been published with the WHO team that have undertaken the WHO guidelines on hand hygiene in healthcare. Next slide. So I've touched a little bit on why I'm committed to talking about this. And given that I've now mentioned the words hand hygiene numerous times, I want to reassure all of you that that's not all that I do, and that's not all that I'm interested in, and I'm not obsessed with hand hygiene. I don't have hand hygiene OCD, as you can see here from this lovely bottle of hand hygiene sanitizer many of you may have seen. You know, this is the image that is now portrayed, not just about hand hygiene, but about infection control overall. And we have to use messages that will work with our healthcare workers, with our public, with our patients, that makes it clear to them that what we are obsessed and interested in is patient safety and preventing harm, and that there are key things that will help us do that. I've talked to you about some personal experiences, but I was fortunate enough again to be recently involved in preparing documentation for NHS Scotland in this instance, which was looking at the evidence base and the recommendations for care bundles that would prevent peripheral vascular catheter infections, central vascular catheter infections, catheter-associated urinary tract infections, surgical site infections, etc. And what we did was we didn't just want to look at the evidence and the academic literature and present that and make it difficult for people to implement that. What we wanted to do was to pitch that evidence against the Scottish Quality Strategy, which has a core of patient engagement, patient involvement as one of its aspects. So we created documentation that took each of those recommendations. It had grading from the evidence as being strong and important to applying practice, but we wanted to look at those recommendations against a number of factors within the quality strategy and consider, were they feasible? Could they be reliably implemented? And what would be the patient engagement aspect of that recommendation? And of course, in some instances, especially for patients in intensive care units, they were not applicable. But there are many instances, which I'll come on and summarise at the end, where, of course, recommendations that we give within policies absolutely have a patient engagement, a patient involvement aspect. And again, I reiterate, when you're next devising policies and guidelines, that has to come from the beginning. I'm also, again, involved in some of the work Margaret mentioned, which makes me even more convinced that when we can make it work in a number of countries, we can make it spread across others. And one of the pieces of evaluation that we're doing as part of the WHO work is around how representation and involvement can actually influence at that macro level, that nothing about us without us, that policy level, where a number of PFPS champions around the globe are actually making that difference. And the PFPS work, which we presented at the IAPO conference this year, looks at a workshop that was kicked off patient involvement groups and champions in the African region, and actually where they've gone since and what influence they've had. And I truly believe there's a lot of lessons learned there. I'm convinced that we need to persevere, and there's still a lot of work we need to do. We all know it takes time to change attitudes. I could easily have put a change curve within this presentation and show you that we're still at an early stage of that. What we do know is that 20% of what should happen actually takes around 17 years to actually happen. And when you think about the patient safety movement, the changes that have been in infection control, the importance that's been given to patient involvement just in the last 10 years, we've still got some way to go. And I like these examples of people that didn't give up. Alexander Fleming didn't give up. Thomas Edison didn't give up. And when I'm having a bad day and thinking I can't make anything work, I love that quote. I haven't failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that it won't work. I really hope I don't hit 10,000 ways that it won't work. But this is important for us to understand. We're not going to get it right the first time. We mustn't let the barriers get in the way. We must continue to work on this. Next slide. I've mentioned a lot about local level initiatives, about global initiatives, and I've talked about the data where we know it's positive, but where there are some challenges, which I'm going to come back to. But what we do need to use is the influence of other leaders that are globally working towards changing our healthcare systems. And for those of you who have not seen this, this is the Turning the World Upside Down by Sir Nigel Crisp and the book that he wrote. And it shows you here the system that we've been working in, which means that the professional science, commerce and government are at the top leading the way. The patients haven't been there at the forefront. And in fact, he recommends and we believe we should try to turn that round. And again, as I mentioned, given the work that's going on in Africa, next slide, I do believe that actually we have examples from where developing countries are actually making the effort to start with the patients because they don't often have the resource or the continuity or the input from those in leadership. And in fact, WHO are helping them to make sure that we can start with the patient at the centre. And an example, which isn't truly infection related, but has an aspect of it, but an example there is a mother and baby tool which allows the patients, the mothers, post-discharge to be able to highlight signs of trouble following birth for themselves or the child. And indeed, this tool has been created and is being tested in India by the mothers, the patients themselves from different regions around the globe. We have to take these examples and we have to apply them to many different settings. Next slide. To also give you some other ammunition, I do believe, and you will all agree, I'm sure, that the value of the consumer movement has actually had a huge effect on our lives and how we view healthcare and, in fact, how we view each other. It's changed behaviours in many countries. And indeed, two-way interaction has been working. And I'm not sure if you can clearly see the picture here, But of course, we know, and indeed it is applied in many countries, that food hygiene is critical. We know that often if you go into a shop where they're selling cooked and uncooked meat, the butcher there will make a clear effort to demonstrate that he is not moving between the two and that his hygiene is paramount to making sure that you do not get infected from an organism with, from uncooked meat. It's also clear that in many situations we would challenge that butcher or refuse to buy the meat. Even if you didn't challenge, you would walk out the store and think that's not going to be safe. We need to consider how this power of our daily lives and this, these consumer movements actually can help us to change attitudes in healthcare. One of my colleagues talked about how, again, difficult it is, but again, consumer movements have influenced this, about the changing attitudes and how we talked about the new role for healthcare workers, how patients need to feel comfortable with that, as do the doctors and the nurses, and this is difficult. In many years gone by, doctors were viewed as gods who would not be challenged. Now, people are challenging. Now, people think that they should because they're able to do that in other walks of life. And we have to try and use those experiences to make sure that we can interact well. I mentioned patient feedback right at the beginning, and I mentioned earlier offline that I much prefer giving presentations where I know I can interact with an audience, and I would, of course, given other circumstances, love to hear your feedback on what you're doing about your patient feedback, whether it's in community settings, hospital settings, wherever. And one of the initiatives in the UK, and certainly in England, which is going to be rolled out across the country, is taken from the consumer movement around going to the cinema and being asked, how likely are you to recommend this hospital? And it's been asked in cinemas, how likely are you to recommend this cinema to your friends and family? And when people say they're not, those settings, like a cinema house, would actually act on that to make sure people want to come back. So these questions are now being asked in healthcare settings. How likely are you to recommend this hospital? Now, it's a very, very subjective question. And in fact, doesn't apply as well to healthcare as it does to other settings, because often patients don't have a choice about whether they'd like to come to that hospital or not. But it is a start. I see this as a clear marketing exercise to engage patients and to be able to say to them as a first step, if we can't do anything else, we want to hear how you feel. Because I truly believe that we're still not listening enough, never mind actually involving and empowering. So this gives us an opportunity to do that. And as I say, in fact, it's going to not be a choice in England in the coming future, and we're going to have clear public reporting on how likely hospitals are to be recommended here in England. Next slide. That's just one tool, one example of a tool that's being used at a simple level to start that engagement process where it doesn't exist. WHO, as part of their toolkit that goes alongside the guidelines that can be found on the web pages, does talk about additional activities that healthcare facilities should consider, especially if you're that advanced leadership status. And that's important because you can't be complacent even if you feel you have improved your hand hygiene, people are on board. We know that sustainability has not yet been truly achieved in any one setting, and leaders must continue to exist to be sure that we constantly improve infection control practices and we share those examples and that leadership with others who need our support. And there are patient involvement and empowerment examples within the WHO toolkit. Next slide. There are many questions unanswered. We aren't quite sure of the efficacy yet because we have some publications, we have examples from other patient safety engagement exercises, but we're not truly sure of the efficacy of involving patients on the actual outcome in relation to infection. We are still concerned about overall patient acceptance, healthcare worker acceptance, that impact on the relationship, and how really are our organisations as a whole supporting this? And that would be something I'd love to hear more about. Next slide. Just to give you some more data, the efficacy of patient participation programs from around the globe does tell us still that there are these challenges. And you can see here I've presented some positive data today, but I did say I would balance that with some of the challenging challenges that we still have, which looks at, in a number of places, did you ask a physician about your hand hygiene, about hand hygiene? as you can see here, that the rates are relatively low. We need to think about how we can continue to use the examples where it's working well and apply it to settings where it will work as role models, as learning experiences for us. One of the biggest challenges I believe we have, so I'll add in take-home message number three right now, which is, on average, doctors interrupt patient monologues after 21 seconds. So if that patient has got so much to tell a physician about how they've been feeling, about their problem, about their progress, many other things that will be foremost in their mind, and they're interrupted after 21 seconds, how do we change things to support them to be able to, within all of that dialogue, actually even ask, inquire about how can I help you to prevent error? How can I be helped to prevent infection in my body? How can we work together on this? This, to me, is a real challenge. And, of course, we know how busy everyone is, but we have to be thinking about system change, all of the work that's going on around making our healthcare system safer, and include communications and that patient involvement within that. Next slide. Just to come back again to focus on the fact that there are many variables associated with the intention to ask. Patients have a paternalistic view of their relationship with healthcare workers. We still know that this is the case, and we have to be sure that we address all of these different variables. We need to, next slide, dig deeper into healthcare workers' feelings and beliefs, as well as patients, but we already know how they feel. And we need to really challenge things like it's too time consuming, it's too difficult, because a lot of it is unfounded. And we need to look at the healthcare culture overall, how we are changing it, and how we can help people to see that those changes are actually going to make sure that they can interact more positively with their patients. Next slide. So we're going to address the behaviours. We're going to consider that we still have many challenges, and many of those are focused on behaviours. So what we want you to think is that from one viewpoint, approaching prevention means, from just one viewpoint, means that we are a little right, but mostly wrong. So as I started to say about infection control and a patient revolution, if we actually are looking at where we are not succeeding in preventing infections or having the best outcome, although we are achieving a lot in preventing MRSA, Clostridium difficile, what's next? How best will our approaches make sure that we prevent error, we prevent harm? And that may well be that we have to change our approach and think about specifically what might make it mostly right and only a little wrong, and that means different approaches and engaging our patients in our work. And again, to quote Charles Vincent, one source of this expertise and experience that often is largely ignored is that of the patient. But I'm sure many of you have positive examples of where this is working, as do I, and I know that we should continue to spread those. Next slide. One of the ways which I'd like to promote that we can actually change the healthcare workers' perceptions of patient participation is going back to that thing that I started with, which was around different real-life scenarios. So presenting to both patients and doctors and nurses different real-life scenarios by watching videos, by actually engaging them what truly happens every day in their interactions and helping them see how they can improve. And this has been published, and in fact, it's a common way that the work that I've been doing at WHO has been applied in different countries, is watching videos and looking at that interaction and seeing where patients and healthcare workers can achieve good infection control practices together. So using videos is a good technique. Next slide. And we can use other things to help make it work. The conceptual model that I talked about, the five-step process for developing a patient empowerment program from Marianne McGuckin's book. Use of different technologies, which I've mentioned, around this M-Check tool developed by WHO. And we can consider not just hand hygiene, or where hand hygiene fits within other aspects of care. We do know that urinary catheter maintenance and the hygiene of those who have a urinary catheter in place can often be managed by the patient themselves. make sure that they are empowered to be involved in that. It sounds simple, but it often isn't when they don't have the facilities to be able to perform their own hand hygiene, their own meatal hygiene. Let's make it easy for them. Let's have plans to make sure that that is a truly interactive process between healthcare worker and patient. For peripheral vascular catheters, you can clearly see that the removal prompts is something patients can be involved in. Surgical site, post-op infection, recognition of signs. Antibiotic awareness, another great positive example. A lot of information being published on this, and indeed the awareness within the community about not taking antibiotics, certainly in the UK and many other countries, is real. And that has been a good interactive process between, for example, patients and their general practitioners. Next slide. I'm almost finished now, and hopefully have time for Margaret to give some comments. But to bring it back to you and to me and to every single person that might be thinking how it feels about going into a hospital and that who may be harmed, let's think about if you wanted to complain to your car mechanic, if you felt you had a concern, you felt you were at risk of crashing your car, being damaged, being harmed, being killed, when would you do it? When would you challenge them? Would you wait till after the harm had occurred? I think not. And I think indeed that's where we need to see an analogy, and we need to build in to that conceptual framework how we actually make sure patients and healthcare workers can interact at the right time on these topics of prevention of harm. To close, I have to bring it back to the WHO 5 moments for hand hygiene. This concept, this model that makes it easier, should make it easier for people to remember, to practice and to act every single day to keep patients safe, isn't just about hand hygiene. It's a model, a human factors approach that can be applied to many different things. It helps people to try to focus on the times when harm can exist and where you can protect your patients and yourself. And I do believe that if we focus on this and the interaction with patients at this time, we will make a huge difference and we will make our jobs easier and we will ensure a better outcome for patients. And as I said, using videos to help people really understand that interaction is what we promote at WHO, and in fact helps people to understand those 5 moments for their practice and for patient safety a lot better. My last slide, I'd just like to thank Dr. Yves Longtan, who I worked with on the presentation for the conference and whose slides I've used, Professor Didier Pittet, who of course gives us constant and apologies for the error in his name there, Didier Pittet, who works closely with us on all of this work, Margaret herself for her leadership, Dr. Benedetta Allegrandi from WHO, Dr. Hugo Sachs from WHO, who was involved in discussing this with me, Julie Storr, who also works for WHO, who helped prepare the slides, and one of my Scottish colleagues, Anne Patterson, for her discussions. Margaret mentioned social media at the beginning. And for those of you who are on Twitter, thank you for your tweets in the last days about this lecture, and those of you who are interested in joining because you'd seen the information about it on the Twitter site. And indeed, I've included some of the Twitter addresses there in case you want to contact people and have ongoing discussions. I do believe that communication is the key to all of this, and in fact that can be done through many different means, through social media, through face-to-face and through meetings, and I encourage you all to do this from here on in to ensure better patient participation from here on. Thank you very much.
Well indeed, thank you Claire. You've certainly given us much food for thought, all of which has been underpinned by some excellent data, and you have provided us too with resources for further reading and for study. So it's not just about this hour today. Going forward, we will actually be learning from your presentation today. So thank you for that. And we do certainly have a few moments for comment. One of the things that struck me was the language you used, particularly in relation to infection control revolution, and you're calling for a patient revolution as well. That is very strong language, but it really reminded me of a conversation I had some time ago with Lucien Leap, who said that he could not understand why patients are not more enraged when they suffer harm as a result of non-compliance with guidelines, processes and protocols. So that really resonated for me. But it's also very passionate, isn't it? We're calling for a level of passion on the part of healthcare workers in relation to not alone this patient safety issue, but many of the patient safety issues. Would that make sense to yourself?
Yes, and I have to start by saying that I have not coined the phrase patient revolution, Margaret, just to be sure. I believe that we should hand in hand infection prevention and control and patients create that joint revolution, which is my passion, my belief. The patient revolution term itself is actually an initiative in the east of England, which has been developed and has been rolled out, and it is about a new way of trying to see patients at the heart of it. And that short survey about how likely are you to recommend is all part of that patient revolution. And it's in its early stages, and it will actually be rolled out across all of England. But I'm fortunate to be part of that just now. But what struck me was that it is a changing time, and we need to be at the forefront of that. And I do not believe we can be at the forefront of it without being hand-in-hand with things like a patient revolution that's going on. So I think that's my passion, that it's really about joined-up working.
Brilliant, brilliant. And when you speak about that survey, you know, would you recommend this hospital? Would you also agree that surveys need to be very meaningful, and in fact that the crafting of the surveys themselves needs patient layperson involvement? Because I would like to see that extended to include, say, a question that if somebody responded, yes, I would recommend this hospital, I would like to them to be telling me why, because then I would know what I need to replicate. And similarly, if they said they would not recommend, I would very quickly identify what I need to change.
That's right, Margaret, I totally agree. And as I mentioned, I think the question can be subjective. In parts of England, it is mandatory to ask. So that's one thing that, and I truly believe that, as I say, it's a starting point. We don't, and I'm sure many others around the country would love to say that that's not all they do. We do many survey questions, and in fact, I think sometimes too much, and I absolutely agree with you. We have to work together to get the questions right. We're often too quick to create surveys. Oh, I think I'll do a survey today. Different people do different things. The questions need to be informed. You need to think about your report before you even start to frame the questionnaire. You have to think about what's going to go into a system, what's going to come back out of it, who it's meaningful for, the context it will give you. There's absolutely no point in knowing something if you don't know how then you can improve. But that's just one example of a question that I think is an engagement technique with patients and the public. I quite like that from, you know, because I think we're all busy, and actually getting people to respond can be difficult, and I think it actually is a good marketing tool to just start the ball rolling.
Yeah, yeah. You also mentioned some feedback from healthcare workers, which said that it was important to them how the question would be asked by the patient. Would you also agree that it is equally important how the question is received by the healthcare workers? Because going forward, if a question isn't received well, that will then inhibit the patient from asking a question, say, with a later encounter with healthcare.
That's right. And I think what I've presented here is that that is an issue. But actually, unless we think about that conceptual model and actually applying that to our practice, we won't overcome that issue. So some of the data I presented was about the fact that questions aren't received well, behaviours and attitudes need to change, and they are shifting, influenced by some hospital activities, by this consumer movement, by our changing world, by recommendations and mandates from leadership. But actually, unless each setting is actually prepared to look, I believe, at that conceptual model of factors and work through them in their context, we won't actually get to a point where questions can be asked and can be received. So it is harder than I'm sure we'd like to admit. But I do believe that also if they take that model and apply it, and I'm sure some people have, and we share those experiences, that we can actually... I don't believe that we can keep putting that barrier in the way and not do something about it. So it's time to see that there are some challenges, that people also want it to work, so how are we going to make it work?
Yes, and I think we're both in agreement around the fact that patients who are vulnerable and are at their least assertive when in hospital do find it difficult to challenge. I have also found in interactions with healthcare workers that they themselves, when they find themselves as patients or as carers for a family member, they also, even though they work within the system, find it extremely difficult to challenge. You also mentioned, and this is probably the last question I'll have for you, you mentioned patient empowerment in the context of engagement and the trying to change attitudes. So do you see leadership as having a key role in that? And should there actually be, and you know when you mentioned that it takes 17 years to bring about change?
Yeah.
That is far too long when you're talking about something that procrastination can be the thief of aim, but it can also be the thief of well-being. It can be the thief of your actual care, your health, and maybe even of life itself. So do you think leaders should have perhaps a zero tolerance in relation to non-compliance?
I think, you know, as you know, Margaret, leadership can take on many forms, and there's different leadership styles. And I think they need to run through healthcare and run through clinician behaviours and attitudes. And indeed, the leadership at the highest level, for example, at national level or chief executive level, often adopts a kind of mandatory zero tolerance leadership type approach. Not all of them, but some of them. And often that's what works in certain circumstances. So rather than being a true change agent within healthcare, which is also needed, you often do get that zero tolerance. And that may well be something that we have to look at as part of a multimodal strategy to making it happen in our settings. And I know certainly that's discussions I've been having in the settings I work in. But leadership takes on many forms, and there are many initiatives I know in the UK where national organisations are supporting leadership at clinician level to give them those skills, to empower them to think differently and to have leadership skills. And that, I think, over the years will start to come through. And that, I believe, will be how you manage it on a day-to-day basis. While, as I say, there's different approaches to change and different leaders will apply different models. Patient leadership is critical, and I do think, as I mentioned, we see that through patient groups influencing a national agenda. And I'm involved in working in surveys with patient groups in the UK so that we, as healthcare workers, with those patient groups, can actually influence government much more strongly than we could on our own. And a lot of developing countries also say that actually the patient voice is listened to a lot more than the healthcare worker voice. So leadership comes in many forms, and I do believe that we have to continue to use a multimodal approach.
Okay. So it looks like it's a combination of changing of hearts and minds and of this this leadership, which might include the mandate. Well, Claire, I really want to thank you for your truly wonderful input, and I think that is all we have time for today. And I hope all of you who have tuned in have found this session to be stimulating, and I thank you for joining us. And I would also remind you of the next teleclass, and the details of that are contained on the last slide. So goodbye for now. And we leave you with, hopefully, a more reinforced resolve to strive for excellence so that all people receiving healthcare are as safe as possible, as soon as possible. God bless you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you.